Welcome back to Franchise Festival. I'm your host, Chris, and today I'm presenting a bonus episode comprised of content cut from Season 1, Episode 18, A Link Between Worlds and Triforce Heroes. As in previous outtake episodes, please note that the sound quality here is just a bit below our typical standards, since it's not been so carefully edited. If you like what you hear, I hope you'll consider backing us on Patreon when Season 2, Resident Evil, goes live later this year. Patreon backers will have access to outtake episodes like this, as well as episodes on spin-offs and other bonus discussion topics. Check out FranchiseFestivalPodcast.com for more details a little later in 2021. Our first set of outtakes concerns additional development details behind 2013's The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds. This is getting towards the end of EAD's existence. I want to say EAD ceased operations in like 2015 or so.
Huh.
And, well, you know, it didn't really cease operations. It just got merged into a reorganized Nintendo hierarchy.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. I was just, I don't pay a lot of attention to stuff like that. So I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't have known about it, except there was some article that I was working on one time, and I was like, oh, this must be an EAD product. It must have been maybe when I was writing about Mario Odyssey or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this screams EAD. EAD was, like, historically Shigeru Miyamoto's
sort
of corner of Nintendo. Mm. And most of the, like, the really big tentpole first-party games are designed by EAD. Or were designed by EAD, but I believe it was following the death of Satoru Iwata, the company was reorganized, and EAD stopped, got rolled up into another department.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some fun corporate history here to kick off our
right.
Link Between Worlds episode. Let's just get to some copyright stuff, and
right?
We'll be right on track to have the most exciting episode ever. And so it was believed that the 3DS's best selling point was remakes of earlier Nintendo games, which is kind of a bummer and is sort of a strange moment in the history of the company, because historically Nintendo tends towards innovation rather than remakes. So, you know, that's this period is sort of the odd man out on that.
Well, I don't know about recently. That's all we've been doing is ports of Wii U games.
Yeah, you're right. This has been, I would say this is kind of the second era of that.
Yeah.
The first, I would say, was the, this is the third era, because the GBA was that way, the Game Boy Advance.
Mm.
That had a ton of ports and remakes of Super Nintendo games.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 3DS had a lot of ports and remakes of early Nintendo 3D games. And now, of course, the Switch is experiencing a lot of ports and remakes of Wii U content.
I think part of that this time around, though, is that the Wii U sold so poorly that the install base for the Switch was really clamoring for those Wii U re-releases, I think. I don't have numbers to back that up or anything, but...
No, you're absolutely right. I actually have seen the numbers on that, weirdly enough, and the difference in sales between versions of games on the Wii U and the Switch is hilarious. Mario Kart 8, for example, continues to this day, despite having launched at this point nearly 4 years ago for the Switch, to be one of the top five sellers every month on the Switch, even though it was originally a Wii U game.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I don't believe it's ever dropped out of the top 10 of the MPDs.
It has
since
not.
Release, has it? Yeah, no.
Nope.
And that's digital, or Nintendo doesn't, does Nintendo, it's either they... They don't include digital sales in that, do they?
I think you're right. I can't remember. Hmm. Truth be told, I don't follow the sales too closely, but that does ring a bell to me. I'm mostly aware of this just because I think it's hilarious that Mario Kart 8 has never stopped being a bestseller. And with good cause. It's the best Mario Kart game.
Oh, yeah.
But other things are the same way. Pikmin 3 apparently sold like gangbusters on the Switch. It's the... it's the best-selling Pikmin game already, even though it was a remake. Hmm. Not a remake, even though it was a remaster. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good point. I think my statement... Sorry, what were you about to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, looking at the overall for 2020, Mario Kart 8 beat the Final Fantasy VII Remake on the NPD sale charts.
That's incredible.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I can kind of believe that, though, because, like... I think a lot of very select people, you had like the hardcore fans of Final Fantasy VII who were going to immediately buy it. But there was already kind of things kind of circulating about rumors how the game was going to present itself. So those who are a little bit less hardcore kind of waited to see the gameplay. And then when they realized that it was very, you kind of had to understand Final Fantasy VII to buy it. I imagine that not as many people actually purchased it. At least that's how my friends did it as well.
I was one of those people. I was extremely skeptical.
And I'm one of them as well.
Yeah, I was not expecting that to be good. So were I to pick one of two games to purchase in whatever it was, March or April 2020, I would have bought Mario Kart 8 over Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Same.
You can't go wrong with Mario Kart. But even the Stranger Wii U games have sold really well on Switch. Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze, for example, was a big hit on Switch, even though they barely added anything to it. Except for Funky Mode. You can't knock Funky Mode. One final detail about the development on this game. This was only the second Legend of Zelda title to feature involvement by Monolith Soft. The first had been Skyward Sword, though if memory serves, we forgot to mention it in that episode. I find this of particular note as a fan of the Xenoblade franchise, which is Monolith Soft's sort of kind of flagship property at this point. Monolith Soft also had its roots in Xenogears, as you can imagine from the name Xenoblade.
I always wondered about that.
Yeah, there was a really great article on... Shucks, I hope I don't get this wrong, but I believe it was on Kotaku maybe a month or two ago that went into the history of Monolith Soft and how they evolved from kind of a group of folks working at Square in the 1990s to becoming their own studio and being picked up by Nintendo as a pretty reliable second-party studio in the late 2000s and early 2010s.
Nice.
Yeah, now they're a key part of pretty much every Legend of Zelda game. Since Link Between Worlds, I think they've worked on every Zelda, and in particular, they were critical to Breath of the Wild being as ambitious as it was, since Monolith Soft had the background in massive open-world experiences that Nintendo lacked.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Our second set of outtakes covers gameplay and story elements, specifically minigames, the disparity between River and Sea Zoras, and a comparison between Link to the Past and Link Between Worlds. Before we move on to the story, something that I don't have here in the notes but I thought might be fun to dwell on for a second is the minigames of Link Between Worlds. Were there any minigames that you folks found particularly compelling or bad in this?
Baseball.
Yes. Chris asks when he knows the answer very clearly.
Yeah, yes. I'm being a little coy. We talked about this a little bit before, but what did you like or dislike about baseball, Spencer?
I mean, I'm sure someone out there is very good at it, but this seemed impossibly difficult. The way this minigame is structured is you stand on the plate, ball is thrown at you, and you hit the button to swing the bat and knock the ball. It's not just about hitting the ball, though. You have to hit targets for points. And as far as I'm aware, you can't do much in the way of manually aiming where the ball goes. The only way you can control if it veers left or right toward what you're trying to hit is how early or late you swing to hit the ball with your bat. And the windows on that were so tight. Yeah. I could not for the life of me demonstrate any sort of mastery over like hitting the targets. It was impossible. And the points you need to get the piece of heart are steep too. It's not like they set the bar low to help you out.
It's, nope.
It's very demanding and very difficult.
I don't
remember. It's pretty punishing.
I didn't play it this time around because I disliked it so much the first time I played, like when the game came out.
Yeah.
I didn't even engage with it this time. I just totally skipped it because I didn't like it.
And I've heard such bad things about it that I kind of just avoided it because no one has anything good to say about it.
Yeah, nope. I played one round and then skipped on out of there. You can get a piece of heart if you play really well at it, but it feels like a pretty steep challenge for a pretty limited reward.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find kind of interesting about this minigame is that it does some sort of mildly creative stuff with the game engine, since this is a top-down Zelda game that's actually presented in 3D. It is able to depict the baseball minigame over Link's shoulder in the style of like a Major League Baseball AAA game, which I think is kind of cute.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't help it, its playability. Wasn't there, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there a similar mini game in one of the earlier Zelda games, one of the earlier 2D ones, maybe one of the Oracle games?
Yes.
It was like top down because you could hit a ball with your sword and it would bounce around and hit targets. It was extremely hard to play there too.
Majora's Mask? No, you said top down.
Yeah, it was one of the one of the top down ones. Yeah, I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find a result for it in my, you know, quick limited searching, so I'm not sure which game it is. But listeners, if you remember, please let us know. How about any other minigames that folks liked or disliked in this game?
I can't really say that I liked any of the minigames. I bounced off of, like, all of them. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all right. Like, the core gameplay is so compelling that it feels a little pointless to do something that's not as... Yeah. Finally honed, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Like the rupee rush, where you basically you bet rupees in hopes that you can like uncover more.
Yeah,
rupees in the like area. It almost reminds me of the digging game, but more than digging, you just destroy stuff trying to find rupees.
Yeah, it's very similar to the digging game, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrible. I could never make my rupees back. I was horrible at it. The cuckoo game, the cuckoo avoiding game was annoying.
Oh, I was going to say I liked that one.
I know. Oh. I was going to say that too. Oh, okay. I really liked that one. It was a return to kind of the weird little bullet hell bosses of earlier 2D Zelda games, but just as a mini game.
Right. Yeah, I didn't spend a whole lot of time on that one. I guess the best one was probably... What was it called? It was the one, the tower.
The Treacherous Tower.
Treacherous Tower, that's
yeah.
It.
That is a pretty cool one.
That was probably the best one. Even though I never made it very far. I didn't really care enough, but you know, if you like it's not quite a boss rush, but it's, you know, fight lots of enemies at once. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that they would do a little bit later in Twilight Princess, the HD remake, where there's that that dungeon where you go through and you need to... Or maybe that was in the original Twilight Princess, now that I think of it. Where it's a sort of series of challenges where you need to fight enemies and then you move on to the next chamber and fight another set of enemies and move on to the next chamber. And every once in a while you can leave. I really like that here. I never completed it all the way because it gets extremely difficult. But I did get through a few phases of it anyway. I think it's probably more compelling because it actually uses the game's core mechanics of combat, as opposed to being some kind of goofy, shoehorned in baseball.
I found it to be a really good place for using some of the upgraded tools, because some of the rooms throw... a very large volume of enemies at you. Right. And even though your sword swings in an arc, you don't have a great way of dealing with that many things on the screen simultaneously. So I leaned on the upgraded fire rod to clear out a lot of the more densely packed rooms. And that was really effective. I did make it through the advanced version of this and got my hands on that super lamp.
Wow. Okay. What does the super lamp do? I never got that.
Mm-mm. So... I didn't know what it did. I thought it was kind of useless. I upgraded it, never touched it. According to the Zelda Dungeon website here, though, it does 8 times more damage to enemies than the normal lamp, making it as strong as the level 2 Master Sword.
Wow. Huh.
That is quite a super lamp.
Yeah.
A very super lamp.
I did not know that the lamp could do any damage to enemies, so I would have just used it for lighting.
Yes.
And apparently if you do... the advanced run through there a second time, it upgrades the bug net, and it just makes the bug net able to damage enemies as well.
Oh, how about that? That feels like kind of a nod to the Easter egg from earlier Zelda games, doesn't it?
That's exactly what I was going to say. It feels like a nod to the hitting back Aghanim's magic with the net.
Right. Yeah, in the original Link to the Past.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah. Yeah. Good catch there.
Do you think being able to so in Ocarina of Time, I've beaten Ganon by reflecting his energy balls with the bottle back at him. I just assumed that was a programming quirk. Do you think that was on purpose? It never occurred to me that they might have done that on purpose as a throwback.
I have no idea.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like it was done on purpose, in that any time that it seems like they've done one of those Easter eggs on purpose, it's been the bug catcher net.
Right.
Because I think you could use the bug catcher net to a similar end in Skyward Sword. I was literally about to say, like, the bug catcher.
Yes, yeah, the bug catcher net has always kind of been that little Easter egg thing. Right. Always reflect.
Yes, exactly. Back
someone.
Yeah, using bottles seems like a glitch.
It does.
Which, admittedly, I guess the original bug catcher's net implementation was a glitch, too. Like, it was. You were not supposed to be able to use the bug catcher's net to fight the final boss.
No, you weren't.
Yeah. I did just want to throw a fun note in here, because this has become, much like, you know, Tingle's presence in the game, something of a preoccupation for me, which is that this is the first Legend of Zelda game that depicts the classic Zelda's River Zoras in a sympathetic light.
Oh, right. Mm.
Since the Oracle games, they kind of retconned the Zoras, so they brought the peaceful allied Zoras of Ocarina of Time and the antagonistic monster Zoras of the earlier Zelda games into a kind of uncomfortable harmony by depicting them as sea Zoras and river Zoras.
Right.
But in this game, there are no sea Zoras. There are simply river Zoras that are friendly and helpful to Link and will talk to him, and river Zoras that will shoot fireballs at him for no reason.
Yeah.
I thought that was just kind of a cute, bizarre re-retconning of the river Zora, sea Zora distinction.
It is. It is.
I like that. And one of the River Zoras is even a sage in the style of Princess Ruto.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, well, you know, I guess we didn't describe the fact that it plays pretty similarly to the original Link to the Past.
Right.
The map layout is the same, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Jasmine, you have a lot more history with Link to the Past than I do. Is the overworld layout one-to-one, or is it just very similar?
I would call it, like, 95% the same.
Huh, okay.
I was able to draw on my knowledge of Link to the Past, Triforce of the Gods, to be able to know where I was going.
Yeah, that makes sense. All the main landmarks are where you would expect them to be.
Right. The only, I mean, there's, you know, that's why I said 95%, because, you know, they're always going to change up some things.
Right.
You know, locations, where people are, you know, that kind of thing. But I would say otherwise, yeah, it's like even Low Rule, I would say was like 95%.
Yeah, Low Rule here stands in for the Dark World of Link to the Past.
Right.
But Low Rule is a little more different from the Dark World than Link Between Worlds Hyrule is from Link to the Past's Hyrule.
Right.
It, you know, it just requires, like, different tools for traversal. One of the interesting quirks of this is that the way that you travel between Hyrule and Low Rule is by having the wall-walking painted version of Link go into these little sort of slits in the wall. And come out, travel through this amazing psychedelic hallway, and appear in the alternate world. So, whereas in Link to the Past, there were little portals that, just due to fast travel and so forth, if memory serves, getting to the desert area of Link to the Past was very difficult because of the fast travel system. In this, getting around is just a little bit simpler. You can also drop. I don't know. I'm gonna.
Okay, because I was gonna say. The only thing I could think of is in this one, in this Hyrule, the desert is actually not connected to the rest of the world, whereas it was in Link to the Past.
Oh, I didn't even remember that.
Yeah, this one is because you have to be able to go there for the second dungeon, in Link to the Past.
Oh, right. So yeah, yeah, I thought that it was cut off.
No, no, no. It is in this game.
How about that?
Yeah.
One of the other nice things about the maps in this game is due to the dual screen and touch screen functionality, you can drop little markers down on the map, which, as we've talked about in other episodes, should be a requirement for any Zelda or Metroidvania game at this point in time.
Agreed. It should be.
Yeah, it became standard operating procedure at Nintendo from this point on, because they would do the same thing with Breath of the Wild as well as Samus Returns, the latest Metroid game.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another feature, since we're talking about the map, that I appreciated was the, when you get to Lowrul, you can touch the Triforce symbol and it'll switch between the two maps.
Isn't that nice?
And it's so nice. It's like, oh, okay, how can I get there? Oh, I have to go over here somewhere. To be able, because, you know, Lowrul is fractured.
Right.
So you're not able to just walk there. You have to go from Hyrule to an area in Hyrule to get there. So it's really nice to be able to look at the map and zoom in and switch between the two areas to figure out, okay, what do I need? What am I missing?
Yeah, that's really cool. And each time that you find one of the passageways between the areas, it then appears on your map.
Yes. Yep. That was very helpful. So you don't have to remember where they were, like in the original, like the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, all in all, I'd say this is probably the best map feature in a Zelda game to date.
I agree. Although, Breath of the Wild is pretty dang close.
Oh, shucks. You know, I meant up to...
Oh, to this point. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah, before
you're
Breath
right.
of the Wild.
Never
mind. Breath of the Wild is the best map, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have to include that. Yeah, up to this point, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
So, another design note here, and it seems like a weird thing to bring up, but it's odd, so I want to draw attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I'm crazy, every Zelda game prior to this, the health has always been in the top left corner, and it's in the bottom left corner in Link Between Worlds.
Is it?
Definitely in the bottom left-hand corner. I can't believe I'm the only one who noticed that.
Yeah, that's really baffling, because in my mind, it's in the upper left-hand corner.
So I just pulled up screenshots from the game to make sure I'm not losing my mind. The health bars are in the bottom left.
I'm pulling up the game, to be honest, because not that I don't believe you. I just want to make sure.
That's incredible that we missed that.
As well. Yeah, I did not pay attention to that at all.
Yeah, this must be... Sorry, I just moved around because I thought I heard... When I heard that it was raining, but I don't think it is. Yeah, this must be the only Zelda game where that's the case, right? Like, it's always in the upper left-hand corner.
I wonder if they did that to, like, draw attention to the stamina mechanic.
Oh my god, you're right. I never noticed that.
How did we miss
that? It is in the bottom left. That's crazy. I had no idea.
Good
I
catch,
didn't even notice.
Spencer. I really wonder why they did that. Yeah, Hamilton, I wonder if it does have to do with the stamina gauge, but like they could have just put the stamina gauge in the upper left too, right?
Yeah. Like they did,
could
like
have,
they did
but I think...
Well, you think it would be like the original. The first game. I was just going to say, it's like the first game where they had the magic. You know, you had the hearts, and then below that you had the magic meter.
Right.
You figured they would have done the same thing, but they didn't. That's interesting. So I'm sorry, Hamilton. Go ahead.
No. I was just mulling about, like, I wonder if they did this because, like, I think they want to put the stamina thing in the bottom right corner. Well, why bother with the hearts, though? I don't know if it's just because it's just different. I'm literally researching right now, and I can't seem to find a reason as to why they did that.
Yeah, pretty baffling. The world may never know. The final section of outtakes includes more information on dungeons. Two of these are dungeons which we cut entirely from episode 18, House of Gales and Dark Palace, while a third clip goes a little more in depth with the Ice Ruins. The House of Gales, which requires the Tornado Rod to enter, this is one of the very few tools in this game that is more or less unique to it. Does the Tornado Rod turn up in any other Zelda game?
Not that I recall.
I don't believe so.
I think this is the only time.
Yeah, it serves a function similar to like upward wind gusts when Link has like the sailcloth or something in Wind Waker, where Link gets boosted into the air, but in this case he uses a tool to do it, the tornado rod. This dungeon is not especially interesting mechanically, but I did like the boss of this dungeon, Margomill.
Margomill. Like Gargamel.
Smurfs x Zelda. Margomill is kind of a series of platforms with an eyeball on top. You have to use the tornado rod to fling Link up into the air vertically while Margomill is headed towards him. And then when the wind gust dies down, Link will land on top and be able to slash away at the eyeball.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
As the fight goes on, Margomill grows extra platforms that make it so Link needs to slash the platforms while Margomill is moving around for Link to be able to get up on top. It's not a super mechanically tough fight, but it's engaging, and again, it plays to the verticality, the depth of the game, that you're doing a lot of moving on kind of the Z-axis, even though this game is ostensibly 2D. Who wants to cover the Dark Palace?
That's with the Jemisar King, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me see. I'm trying to remember what he's in the Dark Palace that made it particularly interesting.
It's dark and you light it up.
That's pretty much all I remember from it, to be honest. Just remember you have to use like bombs to like obviously hit switches.
Right, walls. Because they flip the wall that you're on, so you need to be able to hit the switch at a distance from it.
But other than that, like you just kinda have to kinda go through without light. I guess it's kinda like the what am I trying to think of? Was it called the Dungeon of Darkness? What was it in Ocarina of Time? But it was like invisible walls and floors and things that you kinda had to find.
The well.
The bottom of the well.
Was it the bottom of the well / that kind of dungeon? Kinda gave me those kind of vibes.
That's not a connection I would have made. That's a good point though.
Me neither.
Because the central mechanic here is that lit areas and dark areas depict platforms differently. So sometimes dark areas will show you walls and enemies, and lit areas will show you walls and enemies, but dark areas will show you platforms that you can walk on. And so you need to kind of remember the layout of the area that you cannot see.
Right.
Yeah.
Should we mention the stealth section leading up to this dungeon?
Oh, sure, good. I totally glossed over that. Yeah, that's the only stealth section in this game, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you want to cover that?
Go for it, Spencer.
A little bit of.
Well, I don't recall, I don't remember the specifics, but this has, you have to sneak into this dungeon. It's almost, it's a forest, but it kind of looks like a hedge maze in a way that reminds me of this stealth section in Ocarina of Time, where you have to memorize the guard patterns and kind of scoot around the bushes to get to Zelda.
I was thinking that.
It feels very similar to that, and there is a similar section like that in, what was it? I believe it was Phantom Hourglass or Spirit Tracks, where you're sneaking around a hedge maze with guards. I'm going to cut that.
Spirit Tracks?
Go on.
I'm not sure.
I'm going to cut that. Keep it rolling, Spencer. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The big difference here, obviously, is that you can stick to the walls and move around the walls past the guards. They can't spot you while you're doing that. Some of the walls you can't merge onto, so it's kind of jumping between the guards, memorizing their pattern so that you can get to a wall that you can latch to, and then usually you use that to scoot a little bit further, and then you can hop out at a different part in their patrol pattern. One thing that's kind of neat is if you get caught, they throw you into a jail cell, and these jail cells act as like checkpoints along the way. You don't always have to start from the beginning, but because you can become, you know, you Paper Mario it, you just stick to a wall and then you can just scoot right through the bars and then you're out of jail. You can keep going.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a little more forgiving than stealth sections in earlier Zelda games, which I appreciated. It accomplishes the same end of making you pay attention to where enemies are without just fighting them, while also not punishing you by making you replay lengthy sections of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's a stealth section in Majora's... Majora's Mask, now that I think about it.
There is one, yeah.
The Deku Palace.
Oh, yeah! I always forget about that, actually.
Yeah, I kind of hated that area.
Yeah. Has there ever been a really good stealth section in a Zelda game?
Oh, that's a good question.
No.
What was your take on the one on Wind Waker? I wasn't here for that episode.
I didn't like it.
Where was it in Wind Waker? I forgot.
It was in Ganon's fortress.
The Forsaken Fortress.
I think
fortress.
It was the Forsaken. Yeah, the fortress.
Oh, Niebla.
If memory serves, that one was less objectionable just because you didn't lose immediately if they found you, right?
True.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't. You just had to fight him.
Yeah, it was a little more Metal Gear Solid-ish. Yeah, it was on the less objectionable side of Zelda stealth sections, but they don't get any higher than not good.
Yeah.
Pretty much, agreed. Yes.
So one of the fun things with the Dark Palace is that Link is manipulating light coming in through these boarded up windows up at the top of the Dark Palace that need to be shot down onto a central path at the bottom floor of the Dark Palace in order to open up a passageway to the boss. So it's one of these very non-linear dungeons where Link is trying to open up those light sources as he goes through. I personally missed one of them and couldn't for the life of me figure it out and had to consult a guide. Because sometimes the... shucks, what was it? I believe I had enabled the light source, but had neglected to blow up a platform between the light source and the path that it needed to get to.
Right.
Which really requires, again, much like the ice ruins, a better command of your environment than most recent 2D Zeldas had required.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What did y'all think about the boss of this area, the Jemisar King?
Oh, I'll just go ahead and note. So I looked up the enemies in this, and apparently there's Podongos.
Podongos? Like Dodongos, but ghosts?
No, Kodongo, I thought.
Like Ko, like baby. So Kodongo.
Yeah, like baby. Cute. Yeah, like child.
Yeah, the red Kodongos. So I thought that was like, there's the Dongo family, I guess.
Yep, you're right.
Yeah, you can't get out of a Zelda game without a Dongo somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I thought
speaking of Dodongos, the boss here, the Jemisar King, kind of reminds me of King Dodongo. Though, of course, it more specifically refers to the Helmisar King of Link to the Past, right. Which is itself pretty Dodongo-esque.
Now it's just covered in gems, hence the Jemisar King.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is weird.
Exactly.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is basically just the Helmisar King fight, right?
Yeah.
But also you get rupees and have to light candles every once in a while.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I think if you hit like the gems, you get like rupees or something, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of the bosses in this that are pulled from Link to the Past have a greater mechanical distinction from Link to the Past. But this seems like one of the rare cases where it's pretty much just the Link to the Past boss again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so shiny things on him.
Yeah, I was not thrilled with the Jemisar King. This was one of my least favorite bosses in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same as Helmisar King.
Right. Like, it's not obnoxious, it's just also not engaging.
Kind of lazy.
Yeah, the dungeon itself was a lot better than the boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a bit of a mild complaint of mine, because overall I love this dungeon. I agree with you, Spencer. Mm-hmm. But the inconsistency in when you can drop down from one floor to another and when dropping down leads to your death, just there's no logic to it, as far as I can tell.
I mean, isn't there? As long as there's a platform underneath you, I didn't think it ever actually damaged you.
I can confirm with certainty. Because one of the puzzles, I thought the trick was to drop down onto a platform that had a switch on it from a higher floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the platform below me and went to drop down onto it. But it was, like, too far, so to speak. And so Link simply died floating over the platform.
Oh, that is sort of a bummer.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I was so kind annoying. Of trying to cheat. I was breaking, but I was sequence breaking in a logical way that the game would not allow for.
Oh,
which is pretty
sucks.
Rare, given this game's general allowance for sequence breaking.
Yeah. Huh. Also, ice floors can be, they crack when you walk on them. I remember that. I didn't know they could be repaired.
I didn't know that either.
That's shocking.
Neither did I. I
never even thought to try it.
That would have been really useful.
Yeah, it would have. Like, oh, I needed to know that.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, I really need to consult the wiki while playing, not afterwards.
Right?
I hope you've enjoyed these bonus clips. We inevitably produce quite a bit more content than makes it into a given episode, so it's nice not having it go to waste. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or reaching out via our website, franchisefestivalpodcast.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.